for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new government report found that universities failed to tell parents that an oxygen study of their premature babies could cause blindness or even death. Joining me in the studio to talk about the study and how best to balance risks and benefits of clinical trials, Dr. Michael Carome of Public Citizen and Dr. Kevin Donovan of the Georgetown University Medical Center. Joining us by phone is Dr. Edward Bell of the University of Iowa, one of the 23 universities that participated in the study. If you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Dr. Bell, I understand you're in the midst of a hailstorm.
That's right.
Oh, dear.
So
well,
you may hear some thunder in the background.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly tolerate that. Dr. Carome, let me start with you and ask you to tell us about this study, what it was intended to do, and who participated.
The study goes by the name Support Study, and it is an experiment that was funded by NIH, conducted by 23 institutions that make up what's called the Neonatal Research Network, which are major prestigious research institutions across the country. And it involved an experiment with extremely premature infants in which the infants were randomized to get either a high or low oxygen. And both of those segments or bands of oxygen level were within what infants get who are premature. But what they did experimentally was they randomly assigned half the babies to the low end of that range and half the babies to the high end.
And the parents were not informed of which?
So the parents were informed that this was a study comparing these two oxygen targets for the blood levels in the babies. But according to a letter issued by the Office for Human Research Protections, the parents were not informed about several important things. Most importantly, they weren't informed about the serious, substantial risks of this research, which include the possibility of blindness, the possibility of brain injury, and the possibility of death, depending upon which group the babies were assigned. The consent form that the parents signed did offer the possibility of benefit, that the babies might not experience blindness, a type of eye disease that's associated with premature babies, but it didn't say the opposite. They could have a higher chance of getting that eye disease depending upon which group they were in. In addition, when you read the quotes from the consent forms that were approved by the ethics committee at the lead site, it's clear that other things weren't disclosed to these parents. The true purpose of the research wasn't actually explained. For example, one purpose was to find out if babies were more likely to die if they were put in the low oxygen group or the high oxygen group. That was not disclosed. Also, the true nature of the research, describing what standard of care truly would be versus how this experiment would change the oxygen treatment, was not explained to the parents.
So what were the outcomes?
Well, we had two experimental groups, and in one group, the low oxygen group, there was a higher statistically significant death rate. It was 20% in the low oxygen group versus 16% in the high oxygen group. And then for the severe eye disease that they were measuring, it occurred in 9% in the low oxygen group and 18%, so twice the level, in the high oxygen group. So basically opposite results for death and eye disease between the two groups. With respect to the eye disease, there was substantial research previously known that this would likely be the result, and there was certainly reason to suspect that the mortality data was predictable as well.
So now, turning to you, Dr. Donovan, how typical was this research?
Well, I think when we talk about this research, we need to distinguish it from the other types of research that occur. And this particular study had other things that led up to it. And these are different types of studies. The first thing that sometimes happens is there is basically no research at all. It's kind of the treat and hope approach, where we hope that what we're doing for the patients is good. That actually, back in the 50s, is how oxygen started being used in premature infants in the first place.
I see.
They assumed that, you know, these children were having trouble oxygenating because of their immature lungs. Let's give them oxygen. And, of course, more is always better.
And did the experiments that began in the 50s yield good results?
Well, the interesting thing about it was initially they weren't experiments. They just treated and hoped.
Okay.
Then they started realizing that the treatment itself can have some serious problems. This is where the eye problems associated with oxygen in premature babies were discovered.
So you're saying that that was a known and a given before this experimentation began?
Before the support study, as you were hearing from Dr. Caron, many of these things had been recognized. Now, some other studies that addressed the same issue were different designs. They had retrospective studies, which you could say is, you know, was what we did, did it turn out good? Where you don't actually study it ahead of time or while you're doing it, but just go back and look and say, well, this is what we were doing. We thought it would be good. How'd that turn out? That's useful information. That's how some of the information about eye damage and mortality and oxygen toxicity was developed. Then another type of study is an observational study saying, you know, is what we're doing looking good? The support study was different from all of these, okay? And it actually followed what researchers would call the gold standard, because the gold standard for research studies is referred to as a double-blind, randomized study. Now, unfortunately, the term double-blind shouldn't be misinterpreted in a study where there's eye damage. We're talking about neither the people who are being treated nor the ones who are doing the treatments involved in this research study know exactly where you are, and that's ideal. The other problem these previous studies had is they had conflicting results. And one of the reasons they had conflicting results is not only they were purely observational or retrospective, but almost always these were very small numbers.
All right. And now I want to turn to Dr. Edward Bill, since your University of Iowa was one of the 23 institutions participating. How was the coordination of that study to be conducted? What kind of communication were the individual institutions having with each other?
Hi, Diane. First, I want to say what a pleasure and an honor it is for me to be on your show. I've been a fan for years.
Well, thank you so much.
It's nice also to meet the other guests, at least by phone. The support trial, as the previous speaker said, is was a randomized clinical trial, which is the most powerful and most rigorous form of scientific investigation. And it was really the first such study to be done that addressed the particular issue of how do we know how much oxygen we should be giving to very premature babies for the very reasons that Dr. Caron outlined. And the major point of contention is that that we didn't inform the parents about adequately about the risks of the study, and we, the investigators, happened to believe that we did a pretty good job of that. The OHRP, or the Office of Human Research Protection, had objection to deficiencies in the place where the information was presented in the consent forms. I should explain that the Neonatal Research Network is a network of university academic units that take care of very preterm babies that cooperate to do clinical research that requires more subjects than can be enrolled in a single center.
And I gather you had as many as 1,000 subjects in this study. Is that correct?
Yes, there were 1,316 subjects, which was the number that we calculated in advance would be necessary to examine the main question of the study, which was which of these two target ranges of oxygen would provide the lower risk of the primary outcome, which was severe eye problems or death.
And Dr. Bell, I want to interrupt you for just a moment to apologize to our listeners for the quality of sound of your phone out there in Iowa. They are experiencing a hailstorm, and I fear that that is getting in the way of the quality of the sound. We will do our very best throughout the hour to improve that quality, but I hope you'll bear with us because Dr. Bell is an extremely important voice to be heard this morning. We're going to take just a short break here, and when we come back, we'll talk further with all our guests and one more. And welcome back. I am hoping that joining us shortly is Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He's director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. Good morning, Dr. Kaplan.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Always good to have you with us. I want our listeners to know we had an email from an individual who identified herself as the reporter who first wrote about the support study, Teresa DeFino, and gave a letter to Public Citizen. She wanted to know why there isn't a government speaker on this program. Unfortunately, this entire hour came about starting at 8:30 this morning when we learned that our scheduled second hour guest could not be with us, and this program was put together at the last minute. We did reach out to NIH. We were told that on such short notice, the subject matter expert was not available. Now, to you, Dr. Kaplan, why do you say that the frightening headlines about this study were not justified?
I say that, Diane, because we are in a very difficult area of research. We're not studying a new treatment for babies. We're not studying a new drug or a new device. That sort of study is certainly something that doctors do and should do, and it carries very great risks because you're not sure what the new innovation, the new drug or device or vaccine is really going to do. The study we're talking about now, the support study, is trying to evaluate a existing set of treatments. In other words, doctors are trying to treat babies with underdeveloped lungs. They need oxygen.
Sure.
That is known to have side effects. They try to do it, but there's differences in practice. So you're not studying a new thing. You're trying to figure out among the things that doctors do, a range of standard treatments, what really is the best. And that is a little less risky than just testing a new thing for the first time in babies.
On the other hand, isn't it fair to say that parents participating in this study of their newborns should have been fully apprised of the dangers of either a lesser amount or a greater amount of oxygen intake for that child?
Yes, absolutely. And the government position has been, you still, even though you're studying treatments, the treatments do carry risk. We're not sure which of the accepted approaches is best. So the parents need to hear that. And let me add, we're focusing a lot on the consent form because that's the document we have. But crucial to this is the communication, the conversation that the doctor has with these parents.
Exactly.
You know, Diane, they've got a preemie baby. They're often overwhelmed by that.
Of course.
And to be honest, I'm not sure how carefully they'll read a somewhat complicated consent form. So the conversation is crucial. That's really what you want to see. And I for this type of thing, it would be useful, in my view, if we could ask them some questions, document their answers almost like a quiz, just to show that they really understood.
Exactly. All right. And I want to bring Dr. Bell back in on this conversation. Dr. Bell, how much oral communication was there with parents, not just signatures on forms?
This is a big part of the process and really the most important part. We believe that the key elements of the parents needed were in the forms. In some cases, they weren't located specifically in the risk section because we had said up front that the purpose of the study was to look at how these different oxygen targets affected the risk of retinopathy of prematurity. We feel quite comfortable that the process was adequate and the parents were well informed. If in fact, OHRP would like us to explain as risks the possible consequences of using two different ranges within the normal standard of practice, that's going to change the way all consent forms are done for clinical research, and it has widespread implications. And perhaps that's the way to do it, but it's not the way it's traditionally been done.
All right, Dr. Carone.
Well, I must vigorously disagree with some of the points Dr. Kaplan made. I agree that consent is more than a form, but it's critically important that that form include key elements about risks and benefits and nature of the research. There is reason for alarm for the way this study was conducted with inadequate consent. We think the lack of adequate consent made the study unethical. And it's really misleading to say that for all these babies, getting oxygen anywhere between 85 and 95% represented the standard of care, and that trying to test one versus the other didn't pose risks to these infants. We know from the results of the study that you could change mortality, you could change eye outcomes by manipulating the oxygen. So they found differences between the two key endpoints that they were seeking, you know, that they were trying to find out if there were going to be differences. And if you just look at, for instance, how the risk was described in the consent form, it basically implied there was no risk. Let me read from the possible risk section that OHRP quoted. There is no known risk to your baby from monitoring with the pulse oximeter, the device that's used to measure blood oxygen levels, used for this study. The possible risk of skin breakdown at the site will be minimized by your baby's nurse moving the oximeter, the probe that measures the oxygen, to another arm or leg a couple times a day. I mean, first of all, it's ironic that that was the disclosed risk, because these babies have pulse oximeters whether in research or not, and so that wasn't a risk at all. The risk that should have been described, and I'll ask Dr. Bell if it was, did it say that the risk of being in this research include the possibility of death, brain injury, and blindness based upon the group assignment they went to?
Dr. Bell?
Yes. Well, those risks were present from the very outset of these babies' births as very premature babies, and the issue is whether participation in the study increased those risks. In fact, there was no increased risk of death, and the mortality in both groups, as you know, was lower than what we had seen previously in the network sites, and also what was seen in the babies who were eligible for the study but whose parents declined. Now, I know you're aware that there were some differences in the risk factors between those groups, and we're in the process of sorting that out now, but we feel rather strongly that the babies were not placed at increased risk of eye problems or death simply because of their participation in the study.
All right, Dr. Carone.
So I believe Dr. Bell is referring to a study published by the same group in which they looked at clinical characteristics of the 1,300 babies who were in the support study with 3,000 other babies at the same locations who were eligible, who would have qualified for the study but for various reasons weren't enrolled. And for those babies who weren't in the study, which he's now trying to represent perhaps
who were not,
who were not
in
enrolled
study.
In the study, who he's trying to represent now perhaps as a control group, there were significant differences in the baseline characteristics of those babies. They clearly were a sicker population and different from the 1,300 in the study. And indeed, they had a higher death rate, but that's completely to be expected. And to suggest, to make these comparisons is simply scientifically invalid. You can't compare that different group to the babies in the research. And the purpose of the article, the scientific journal article that described these results, was to make the point they were different. And therefore, we can't generalize our support study results to all babies who are premature.
Dr. Kaplan, considering the outcomes and considering the questions raised about the outcomes of this study, would you believe that the approach to parents needs to be different, more specific, outlining more carefully the pluses, the minuses, the cost, and the risk?
I think in studying existing range of treatments where there are lots of variations, whether it's preemie babies or going to the dentist or how someone treats a heart attack, the practices that are out there in our hospitals and on the part of doctors still vary, even though they're within a range of accepted practice. We have to figure out within that range what's best. Parents need to understand that type of study. They need to really understand that what's being proposed is to refine and determine within existing treatments what's best. I don't think, and I'll stand by my statement, that that is as risky or as dangerous as trying a new thing for the first time, but it does, because of the nature of the assignment of people to one treatment or another, potentially shift the risk ratio. But parents need to understand it, and the way we're going to get that done, I'm going to say this again, particularly for parents of preemies, is good conversation and quizzing them. I know lawyers and others love those forms. I know bureaucrats love those informed consent forms. I've been around long enough to know that a parent of a preemie baby is going to listen to what the doctor says, not so much what's written on the paper.
All right. Dr. Bell, to what extent had the parents of the infants who were part of that study, been, now that the study is completed, have they been told that their child was at risk?
Before I answer that, Dan, I'd like to just address one point that Dr. Carole made that I think is very important. And he said the fact that the study found a difference in mortality proves that we should have informed parents of that risk. As a matter of fact, there was no reason for us to suspect that there would be a difference in mortality, and that was a surprising finding. We felt that, of course, it was very important to publish that result, and it has, in fact, changed practice for the benefit of very many babies. And with regard to your question about whether the parents have been informed subsequently, we are quite worried that this debate is alarming parents and raising great concerns that their children may have been harmed by participation in the study. And most of the participating centers are considering the best way to communicate to parents to make sure that they understand that our motives were only to help babies. That's the reason that we're here, and that's the focus of our job and the research that we do, and to offer to try to answer any questions that they might have. We're also interested in improving the consent process, and we are looking for advice from families as well as from government agencies about the best way to do that.
Dr. Edward Bell, he's a neonatologist at the University of Iowa, one of the 23 institutions that participated in the study. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to open the phones. I want to hear what our listeners have to say. First, let's go to Veronica. She's in Houston, Texas. Hello, Veronica. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Diane. Long-time fan, first-time caller.
I'm glad to have you with us.
I'm a doctorally prepared registered nurse. I have done research myself, and I have sat on a number of institutional review boards. And my biggest question is, where was the IRB? This is terrifying that you have people on an institutional review board that are not asking the right kinds of questions and providing specific oversight and supervision of these kinds of pieces of research.
Dr. Kevin Donovan.
I think that's a very reasonable question. I think that there are some points that need to be made about this study and the response to it. I think perhaps the first point that shouldn't be lost is the study was worth doing. We didn't know the outcome in advance. There were reasons to suspect some of these outcomes, but some of them were surprising, including the fact that the data suggested there was an additional death for every two cases of severe retinopathy that was prevented. That's going to change the practice in the treatment of premature babies. However, as not only a bioethicist, but a pediatrician and a former IRB chairman, I will tell you that studies in children need to be approached differently. The protection for children is built in to be much greater, and it should be. The children themselves are not doing the consenting, their parents are, and involvement in the study should have some prospect of benefit. I would also disagree with my colleague, Dr. Art Kaplan, about the consent form just being a bureaucratic piece of paper. We were very particular about consent forms when we ran the IRB, simply because this is what people have to take home with them. They can listen to the doctors, but they may or may not remember what they've heard. This is the doctor's only documentation of what was said and what was done. And I think in this case that the criticism is well-founded, that the consent form didn't really make it clear what exactly was being studied and to the extent that there might be additional risks because of the study. I think that the worst thing that could happen from this is to say, you know, the alarmist view that this was a huge breach and great problems for the involved babies. And as a result, we see less involvement, fewer studies done, because then we're working blind and we don't know how to help kids in the future.
So you're saying that you believe that the studies have been necessary, but you're also suggesting that parents have not been sufficiently informed of what those risks actually are.
I think that really is the issue at hand. And I think that Public Citizen, as Dr. Crone has said, and the OHRP have both made this point. I'm afraid the point's valid.
All right, and we'll take a short break here. Dr. Kaplan, I do hope you can stay with us as we take more calls. 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the hell of American daycare. We talk with Jonathan Cohn about his cover story in the New Republic. 40% of children under 5 are in daycare, but he writes that the overall quality of daycare is wildly uneven and barely monitored, and at the lower end, it's Dickensian. Join us.
Welcome back, Dr. Kaplan. I understand you can stay with us for just a few moments, so I'll take this call from Jo Helen in Durham, North Carolina, and get you to respond. Good morning, Jo Helen.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment. I am a mother of a micro preemies. I had twin girls born at 26.1 weeks at Duke University due to twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. And I just would like to agree with some of the comments that we as parents in those situations, we have no idea what's happening. We are so overwhelmed and concerned and just overwhelmed. And I do agree that the verbal conversations the doctors have are so much more impressive upon our decision-making process than maybe reading through all that legalese of a contract.
I'm sure. Dr. Kaplan.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I know we've been arguing a little bit about the importance of the written informed consent form. It is important. It should be accurate. Again, I'm going to say in my own experience and looking at studies, what the caller says is 100% true. The conversation, the communication, particularly with parents facing a catastrophe with their baby, is key. If we're going to make sure that parents understand when we're studying different approaches to treatment, that they're being asked to be in a study of those treatments, we have to quiz them. We have to use things like videotape. We have to tell them to tape record when they come into the unit so they can remember things. I hate to say this, but the forms and the IRBs these days are captured very much by lawyers. If we want to empower parents and really make them understand and be able to participate, it's that conversation and then going back and forth to establish comprehension that's key. And Diane, this is true not just for this preemie study. We're going to see this issue come up for many, many other attempts to study differences in treatment.
All
that's
right.
What we're talking about here is studies, so-called comparative effectiveness research. There are a lot of things out there for many different diseases where there's a range of approaches to what's best to do. We want to narrow that and figure out really what is best to do. So making sure that we all understand when that option is put before us, clearly this particular preemie study has a lesson that's going to be much larger for many of us in terms of where future research is going.
Arthur Kaplan, director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center, thanks for joining us, Dr. Kaplan, and to you, Dr. Carome.
Just a couple of points. Dr. Bell and Dr. Kaplan keep saying we have this range of treatment and we don't know where is the right place to try to treat people along this span of oxygen levels. And they imply that for all comers, for all premature babies, anywhere within the range might be good, and there's the same good spot for every baby. And that's, we have spoken to intensive care physicians, neonatologists, pediatricians who are not affiliated with the study, and they explain that typically the oxygen level for babies is adjusted and customized based upon individual clinical factors, as well as considering the wishes of the parents who may want to take risk of a high oxygen at the expense of some other benefit. And let me just give you an example of that may be better understood by your listeners. Suppose we talk about education, and I have kids in high school, and they take math classes, and there are three levels of math classes, all considered within normal education practice. We have advanced placement college-level courses, we have college prep courses, high school level, and then we have remedial math courses. That's the range of normal mathematical education. Suppose we took, and there are reasons why students are in the AP class and other students in the remedial class, because they have different skill sets, different backgrounds, and different cognitive development that allows them to perform at a certain level. Suppose we took all of the children at my son's high school and randomly assigned them to the remedial education math program or to the high program. Some children are going to be hurt. Some children in both groups aren't going to do as well as they would if they got the individual math class that they should have been in. And that's a better an analogy of what failed in this study.
And here's an email from Lisa in Indianapolis. Were the doctors prohibited from adjusting oxygen levels based on their best judgment for what the patients needed? If not, wouldn't many of these infants have suffered blindness or death regardless of enrollment in the study? Dr. Bell.
Well, the medical teams caring for these children were permitted to provide additional oxygen or restrict the oxygen if needed. And I agree with one thing that Dr. Carome said, which is that the ideal would be to have individualized care plans so that each baby could have the oxygen saturation target that we know is the best for that baby. Unfortunately, we don't have the information to make those judgments, and the support trial is one of the first that provides us with some basis to make those decisions with the participation of the parents, letting the parents weigh the risks of higher versus lower oxygen saturations. But it's misleading if neonatologists have told you that they are able to individualize oxygen therapy, because we just don't have the scientific evidence to support that.
All right, and here's an email from Gail in San Antonio, who says she was born in 1953, went to school with a blind boy who was also born prematurely. He was blinded during his time in the incubator from the oxygen levels. If it was known in the 1950s that high oxygen levels caused blindness in these infants, what was the level of, quote, high oxygen used in this research compared to that of the 1950s? Why would this research include high levels of oxygen if this risk was known 60 years ago? Dr. Bell.
That's a very important question, and we've had a number of people claim that we should have anticipated this based on the findings from the 1950s, but those were very different days. Those were not carefully designed experiments. Babies were placed in incubators when incubators first became available. We had a way to deliver high oxygen, and the oxygen was just pumped in at 10 liters per minute or more, and there was no way to measure the oxygen in the baby's bloodstream the way we can now. And so to say that we should have known from that experience that using oxygen saturation targets carefully controlled within a narrow range would place babies at increased risk is just delusional.
Interesting. To Sheila in Jacksonville, Florida, you're on the air. Sheila, are you there? Sheila?
Yes, hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Please go right ahead.
I had a few questions. My first one was one of your guests earlier said that more oxygen, he said obviously more oxygen is better. So my question is, would the protocol be that the sicker the preemie, would that preemie automatically be placed in the more oxygen group or the less oxygen group?
Dr. Bell.
I didn't hear all of that. But
she said that it had been said on this program. I'm not sure exactly how, and maybe Dr. Donovan, you want to...
Oh, the more oxygen is better.
Right.
And yeah, that was an assumption in the 1950s. We now know that too much oxygen is harmful, just as too little oxygen is harmful.
Right.
And we're trying to learn where is the best place between those extremes to manage premature babies.
So the second part of her question, the sicker the preemie, the more oxygen likely, Dr. Donovan?
I was the one who said that as an example of the rough thinking about this type of problem that was available 50, 60 years ago. Clearly, we have learned much more, as Dr. Bell just pointed out, that more is not always better. And in fact, trying to customize, as it was said, the treatment for an individual patient can't be done without good data. That's what this support study was trying to do, was to fine-tune the data so that we really would know the breakpoint between too much oxygen and too little oxygen in terms of increased risk of death or an increased risk of eye damage.
All right, and to you, Dr. Carome, is your primary issue with this entire subject the consent form or the degree of conversation with parents, informing them of the risks, or is it the study itself?
I think we have our concerns are twofold. We certainly have concerns about the consent form and process being inadequate and not fully informing these parents so they didn't make an informed judgment about whether to put their babies in the research. Dr. Bell said nothing to suggest that the way the benefits and risks were described were any different than the form. Secondly, beyond the consent form and process, we have fundamental concerns about whether this research as designed was even ethical in the first place. It gets to the lack of a control group that got usual care without manipulating it experimentally. We only had two experimental arms, so we don't know for the population as a whole and for subsets of the population whether indeed they've established what's the ideal way to manage oxygen in premature babies.
So, Dr. Bell, how do you respond?
Well, for babies who are not in the study, there is a very rough understanding of what the oxygen levels should be, and there is tremendous variation depending on the baby, the physician, the hospital. By doing the research, we just bring some order to that variation so that we can learn something from it. All of the consent forms, in fact, explained quite clearly that the main focus of the study was to see which of these ranges of oxygen might help protect the eyes more from retinopathy of prematurity. And it seemed quite obvious, and our parents seemed to understand that was the purpose of the study. And so the rate of eye problems might be higher in one group or the other, but that was not stated specifically in the paragraph on risks in some of our consent forms. And going forward, I think we'll be careful to do that.
And go ahead, Dr. Donovan.
I think I would like to echo that point. I would differ from Dr. Karom on this. I think there were problems in the consent form as we have heard it described, at least in some of the institutions that used it. I think that the criticisms are aimed at the consent process, not at the study. The Office for Human Research Protections of the federal government, nor I, find that the study itself was unethical. We think that the study was worth doing, but the risks and benefits have to be clearly delineated for informed consent.
Dr. Kevin Donovan, he is director of the Pellegrino Center for Clinical Bioethics at Georgetown University. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Would you agree with that, Dr. Karom, that it was the form, the consent process, but that the results of the study do have some worth?
Dr. Donovan is correct. The Office of Human Research Protections only cited problems related to the consent form. The concerns about the design of the study possibly being unethical, I'm raising those on behalf of our group, and we have spoken to other experts in study design who share our concerns about the ethics of the study design. So I don't think there's unanimity that this study was well-designed, ethical, and perhaps it shouldn't have been conducted the way it was.
Dr. Bell, if you had a preemie, would you have put that child into this study?
Absolutely. And in fact, I would argue that it would be more unethical to continue the willy-nilly treatment of babies without any knowledge of what we're doing, that would be more unethical than to try to find the answers.
So what is your conclusion from this study as far as going forward in the treatment of preemies is concerned?
Well, as was explained earlier, the babies whose oxygen levels were kept in the lower part of the normal range, we found had less eye problems, but to our surprise, had a higher risk of death. And when we examined these babies at 1.5 to 2 years of age, there was no longer a difference in the eye problems. And so we've taken this to mean that the higher oxygen saturation range, while it may cause more eye problems in the short term, it also saves lives. And most of our hospitals have adopted the use of the 91 to 95% range as our target.
Dr. Karom.
And as I think his comments imply, there was a higher death rate overall by the time they measured outcomes to approximately 2 years. So in addition, no difference in the blindness outcome, but more deaths in the group that got lower oxygen.
Dr. Donovan.
I would agree with that. I think that also gives us reason to believe the study needed to be done because it changed what had been the traditional practice, the normal interventions with a much wider range. Now a narrower range of oxygen will save lives. This was information that surprised the investigators to some extent because it wasn't known with certainty beforehand. This is, to me, exactly why studies like this need to be done, but need to be done carefully.
Dr. Karom.
The study could have been designed better had it had an appropriate control group and would have been more informative. I think ultimately, you know, we've called on the secretary to take action that goes beyond what OHA should be called for. We think the parents of these babies deserve a personal apology and a full disclosure of the information they were not provided with. We're also concerned that there are several other ongoing high-risk studies in the same types of populations by the same group of researchers. We have demanded that the Secretary make the protocols and consent documents for those transparent, publicly available on a website so that independent experts can look at that. And we plan this afternoon to write to RHP to take emergency action to make that happen.
Dr. Michael Carome, he is with the Health Research Group at Public Citizen. That is, of course, a consumer advocacy organization. Dr. Kevin Donovan, director of the Pellegrino Center for Clinical Bioethics at Georgetown University Medical Center, and Dr. Bell, he is professor of pediatrics at the University of Iowa. Thank you all so much. And
thanks
for listening.
You're welcome.
I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from